Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
You have to know, you have to feel what your son felt and to think why and how, what led up to this. Just, it's horrible.
I mean, the name, Malat, I mean, the fact that the murder is committed in Belanglo State Forest, I mean, this immediately makes one's flesh creep.
Malat was also found guilty of abducting an 8th backpacker, the one who got away, Englishman Paul Onions. Without him, Malat might still be at large, still killing. It's only through his evidence were police able to pinpoint Malat as a murderer. Onions, you see, had gone perilously close to being another victim, and the experience had haunted him. If horror has a human face, then its name is Ivan Robert Malat. Australia's worst serial killer was found guilty yesterday of murdering 7 backpackers.
We'd heard about his uncle, we'd heard his surname that many times. Like, he did brag about it, true.
Yeah.
Like, he looked up to his uncle, and he'd made that clear.
Ivan Robert Marco Malat, Australia's own Ivan the Terrible. This is the face of a serial killer.
Nothing can get them back. Nothing.
A killer with the dead eyes of a shark and the ferocity to match. Brutal, cunning, merciless, predatory. His name alone synonymous with death and now dead himself.
I don't think you get much worse than a cold-blooded killer.
It was the biggest murder story I've known in the last 40 years.
Malat's murderous rampage changed perceptions of the friendly country.
The murder of 7 backpackers, including 2 British girls.
If horror has a human face, then its name is Ivan Robert Malat. Australia's worst serial killer was found guilty yesterday of murdering 7 backpackers.
He died alone in a barren prison cell, an outcome many believed Ivan Malat deserved when he was convicted 23 years ago. Australia's most notorious serial killer lost his battle with cancer in the early hours of this morning in Sydney's Long Bay Prison Hospital. He was 74, serving life for the brutal murders of 7 young backpackers.
Hello and welcome to episode 75 of Who Killed? I'm your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media production. On this week's show, I will be talking with the hosts of the Evidence Locker podcast about a case down under, the Ivan Malat backpack killer case. If you are unfamiliar with this case, it is definitely worth looking up, but Sonia and Noel really know their stuff. And I would be doing a disservice to the story by continuing on. So let's jump into my conversation with Sonia and Noel from the Evidence Locker podcast. This week on my passion case, I am very lucky to be joined by the folks over at Evidence Locker from the other side of the world in Australia. Welcome to my passion case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're lucky to be here.
Well, I'm lucky to have you. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Now, I'm Noel Vinson, the host of the Evidence Locker.
And I'm Sonia Lowe. I'm the producer and creator of the Evidence Locker.
Very cool. Now, what is it that got you guys into the podcasting game?
Sonia, I'll let you lead with this one.
I've always been a true crime junkie. I've loved watching it on end. My husband kept telling me, can you maybe do something with your strange hobby? Because I'm a script writer by trade. I wrote for a soap opera for many years. And I just needed to keep on writing. And yeah, I guess I took my job and made it my hobby. And I do the research and the scripts. And Noel is my good friend. And you can tell a bit more about how I dragged you in, no?
Well, essentially, we knew each other in Sydney, and we would make films together. And I like to pride myself on that I made Sonia direct a horror film.
In my daughter's bedroom.
In her daughter's bedroom. Okay. And, you know, from there, it's just... we kept, you know, just sort of getting each other's backs with creative endeavors and things like that. And as life would have it, Sonia and her family moved to the Southern Highlands of Australia and kept the creativity going, started the Evidence Locker. She told me that she was doing a podcast and she would love it if I would, you know, host it. And I was like, yeah, of course, no problem. And yeah, that first episode definitely taught me what I was in for, because it was a Swedish case. And I realized, okay, so this is going to start becoming a little bit tough with certain pronunciations and things, but she bared with me and she teaches me, and I learn from doing these podcasts more than I would ever imagine to learn. So it's an awesome part.
Nice.
Well, you guys have quite the interesting connection. So what, writing for a soap opera, that must have been pretty wild.
Yeah, that sort of helps you to bring the drama, I suppose, and sometimes a bit of tongue-in-cheek comedy.
You got to have a little bit of sense of humor in some of this stuff.
Yeah, you do. To help you as a sort of coping mechanism with the dark stories that we read. But the case we're talking about today, I'm from South Africa originally, and Noel, as you can tell, is from the States. So we're both not native Australians, and this isn't the case that we knew about. It's not one that came on our radars in the countries we lived. So when we came here, it was about 2011, I think, when I heard about Milat for the first time. It was a documentary on Crime and Investigation Australia. And it was just quite horrific that I hadn't heard of him, because I do like listening to all things true crime. And yeah, it sparked an interest.
And for me, I was just going to say that because I was a horror movie fan, I knew the movie Wolf Creek. And in researching Wolf Creek, you find that some of it was based on Ivan Milat. So that's how that came onto my radar. But I really didn't know the details and deep dive into anything until being in Australia and hearing more about it. Because it is, you know, not to glamorize it, but it is like the premier Australian case, I believe.
Yeah, with that being said, and you being from the States, is it like a Bundy type of case where it's like famous on that level?
Yeah, in Australia, it would be. There are their fair share of killers here, but Ivan Milat definitely takes the cake. And I mean, he was definitely a special dude, you know, just the background and all that good psychoanalysis that goes into those kinds of things.
Yeah, so as far as the case goes, we are talking about Ivan Milat. It's Milat, right?
Milat.
And now, he is famous to a degree in the States. He's got a name, you know, he's the backpack murderer. And I've definitely listened to more than a few podcasts on his case. Could you give the listeners a little bit of a background on what brought him into the world of, deviancy?
You go with this one, Sonia, and then I'll chime in.
Ivan Milat was from a very large family. It was a migrant family, like many Australian families. They were 14 children, and they lived just outside of Sydney in on a small farm. All the kids were involved in keeping the house and going to school. They sort of raised themselves in a lot of chaos.
They were very tight-knit.
Very tight-knit. They got into a lot of trouble. But if only one got into trouble, that's the one that took the fall for the rest. So they've always had this band of brothers.
And you said there were 14 of them?
14 children, yeah.
14. Wow. And you said they basically raised themselves?
Yeah, the mother was, and father, the father was quite violent.
Alcoholic.
An alcoholic. Immigrant from
Croatia.
East Bloc, Croatia. And the mother, they met in Australia. So I just think she was quite the matriarch. And even to the end, she was the matriarch. But because there were so many of them, they were expected to help out in raising the little ones and things like that.
Like, where did he fall as far as the hierarchy of the family went?
Well, I couldn't tell you what number child he was, but what comes across in research is that I guess he was the most charismatic one. He was the one who, whatever he wanted, he would get. So there was a little bit of a little bit of beef that came from the fact that Ivan, he wanted to. He was interested in one of his brother Boris's wife. So they had an affair, right? And then a child came and Boris raised it as his own, but the family sort of knew who the real father was. So that sort of put Boris at odds with Ivan for the rest of their relationship. And then, you know, he also dated or had an affair with the girlfriend of another brother. He had an affair with his cousin's girlfriend. So there was something about him that these women gravitated to. And I think they say he was like, there was something about power that he had. But even within all that, it was still very tight-knit, and he was still sort of a protector of that whole brotherhood.
He was fifth in the pecking order, by the way. He was a fifth.
Okay, so he was kind of like right in the middle.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds like something right out of a soap opera.
One might want to say, yeah. So I think you want to be careful to use the word hillbilly, but I mean, that was sort of the vibe, right? It was your brothers, your sisters, your cousin. It was very incestuous, and there was also a big implication. Like later on, people believed that he had an incestuous affair with his sister, Shirley. And she has even been pinned to have been involved in many of the murders.
Accessory to the murders, yeah.
Really? Now, I was always under the impression, I guess we are kind of jumping ahead there, but I guess I was under the impression that he had acted alone, but yeah.
It's never been proven. It's only a speculation.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. No one was ever charged. Maybe to rewind a little bit. So he was from this large family, and they were very violent. They had guns. They shot animals and hunters, but they shot anything and everything they could find, targets. They really loved their guns.
And they would have barbecues, you know, and it was that very, like, this is what we do. This is what normalcy probably is to that particular family.
Yeah, and they would fight, and then the mother would get involved and pull them apart and that sort of thing.
Yeah, if I may, I'm sorry, Sonia, just on that bit where how Ivan had the affair with Marilyn, who was Boris's wife. Boris, actually, there was a moment where Boris attempted to kill him, spurned on by Stephen, the father. Like Stephen said, he disrespected you like that. He disgraced you. He needs to die in regards to Ivan. But I can't ask you to do it because he's my son. And that was sort of the words that he had said. Boris took that upon himself to kill his brother in an act of revenge. And he aimed at a family barbecue. He aimed a gun at his brother, Ivan. But his mother, Margaret, kept getting in the way of Ivan. And nothing ever came of that. It's just deep in their, you know, their anger towards one another. At least Boris is towards Ivan. Ivan probably just could really care less the way he was, you know.
So that was the dynamic. That was the sort of dynamic in the household. Yeah, he deserves to die. I can't tell you to kill him. Try to kill him. And then the mother, literally, she physically would stand up, but not say, don't shoot your brother. She would literally dish food into their plates. Every time he pulled the gun, the mother would stand up and stand in between. So, that was...
So when's this movie coming out?
Well, actually, funny you say that. There's been a few. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
And Noel has worked with the actor who portrayed
Malat. Yeah.
Well, give it a plug. Come on.
Oh, well, it's a proof of concept. It's a short film called Dusters. It was finished literally 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
So it'll hopefully make some rounds in the film festival world, you know, and lucky enough to cast the insane character as the lovely gentleman who played the insane Ivan Milat. So yeah, definitely lucked out with that. And it's just, you know, it's just ironic how that sometimes happens.
So he's growing up in this wild household of just rambunctious children and just lawless children, it sounds like, and a mother who's not quite willing to tell the children not to kill the other children.
Not an enabler per se.
I'm just laying it out there. This is getting a little weird. We haven't even gotten to the weird part yet. So, all right. So what age is it that he, let's say, heads off on his own or starts into his world of, I guess, seedier crimes that are outside of the family?
So what you need to know about Milat is there's so much speculation about exactly when he started and the exact scale or the amount of people that he actually did kill. In the end, it was only seven that he's only ever been convicted of 7 murders, but not that that's only, 7 lives are many, but it is believed that it is many, many more. He worked on the roads. He was on road construction.
Like filling potholes, you know, things like that, just painting lines, the kind of thing that the road services do, yeah.
Yeah, I was in college. I painted. I was the guy that put the cones on the painted lines in the service department.
In good company. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, great. I've probably worked with one.
It does give you a good cover when you think about it. Like
that's actually ironic because the first case that I went looking into, that is the first. Those are the first departments I started looking into as far as who was there and who wasn't there on the day that the crime actually took place.
Oh, no. Well, there you go.
Not to paint everybody with a broad stroke. That is not what I'm trying to do by any stretch. So he's working on the roads. So he's kind of like, so he's basically...
He's everywhere.
He's all over the place.
So it just needs to be said that he always had brushes with the law. The whole family had. With thefts and break-ins, and he stole a car, and he went to jail for 2 years when he was in his late teens. So he's always sort of had the criminal side to him, of which many people speculate many of those crimes were committed by one of the brothers, and the police just took the one that said, "Okay, yeah, I did it."
And that's the thing, is it wasn't one bad egg; it was sort of a rotten carton. You know, I mean, not to generalize it in that way. But yeah, he had brothers who were also just as violent.
They would always take the fall for each other.
And that's what made it difficult too, because even they were operating under different names, you know, like there was a few who worked for Borrell, which if I am correct in saying Borrell is a company with that was who was doing the roads. Yes, Sonia?
So it's more of an engineering factory. That's more on that part of it. But I think they do make,
well, because Richard Millat worked there, but Richard Millat went under the name Paul Miller, and Paul Miller was a name that was tossed to the police when they were doing investigations once, you know, bodies were coming up and being found and things like that. And, you know, he worked with his brother Alex Millat, and then Alex Millat was questioned. And because of this whole sort of web that they would spin and, you know, basically try to spin any eyes away from themselves as Millats.
So it was very hot.
I'm just blown away by the willingness of the brothers to just take the fall for one another and just be like, that was me. That
yeah, right. I look like the most probable suspect. Yeah, why not? Say it's me. I'll go to jail for a couple of months.
I guess blood is thicker than water. No pun intended.
Yeah, and it really was the case with the Millats. It's really blood thicker than water, even to the end. So he was in his late 20s. It was 1971, was the first case when he was actually suspected of kidnapping hitchhikers in New South Wales. It was two women that came forward, and they said he had given them a ride, and then that he pulled over and he threatened to rape them. The one got away and the one didn't. He did rape her. He did not kill them. So, I mean, in those days, in 1971, it was very hard for the victim of sexual assault to come forward. But those two girls did. They were only 18 years old. They were Australian backpackers. He somehow got off. He was found not guilty.
Oh, so they actually took him to trial and everything.
They took him to trial and everything, but he did get off, after which he went to New Zealand and spent some time in New Zealand. So heaven knows what happened over there across the pond.
Right.
He spent a whole year in New Zealand, and then he came back to Australia. And then his next arrest was for another robbery and things. And he was a truck driver for a while.
Well, that would fall right into line with all the serial killers that are the majority of serial killers. I mean, they have a whole initiative here in the U.S., you know, the FBI task force. They've got a highway serial killer initiative because there's so many of them that are connected to that type of crime, because it's just one of those jobs that's so conducive to, one, you're by yourself, and two, you can pretty much come and go as you please.
Well, if you're thinking in Australia too, how big Australia is as a country, right? And then within how big Australia is, how empty it actually is. Like, you got probably one of the biggest land masses with the smallest population. The population of LA is like 10 times bigger than the population of entirety of Australia. So if you are working on these roads, you have, you know, you can do anything. You can get away with anything. Nobody's going to know where to find it. You know, it's kind of, it is.
And that is why people also hitchhike, because there aren't necessarily always buses or trains going to specific scenic places where backpackers like to go. I think obviously after Milad, backpacking changed in Australia somewhat and people stick to the main routes.
Social consciousness has changed for sure after all that.
But I mean, his main time of operation began really in the early 90s.
And when you say that, you're talking about, right, Sonia, the seven that we know about.
Seven that we know about.
So you're saying that he could have been committing crimes basically from the 70s up until 90 and or 91 when the first known victim is actually known.
Put it to you this way. Fast forward a little bit. So Milad has recently died, right?
Okay, right.
And everybody was expecting him to come clean about everything he did and reveal how much people he actually killed and where they were. He never did. So the whole thing is, yeah, they're still probably could be in the 10s, 20s, you know, even more, who really knows if that was his, you know, time of operation. But nobody will ever know now.
We'll never know.
And the grave without saying, yeah.
Even one of his brothers said, was it Alex that said in an interview?
I think it was Boris. Boris is the one who flies the flag anti-Ivan, yeah.
And then, yeah, he said on Australian television, he said, you don't know the extent of exactly how many it was. It's a tremendous amount, which denotes he probably knows more than he's saying, but he's a Milets.
And that's the thing. He probably would tell the truth to them, and they would keep, you know, bite their tongues or whatever, or maybe even pat him on the back. Who knows?
Yeah, it sounds like they would kind of take that one and either, I mean, it sounds like if he was committing crime, because nobody just wakes up one day and, because how old was he in 91?
So he was born in 44.
So, nobody starts killing at 45.
No.
No, it's something that's always been in you somehow. And I think there's a part of him that's the narcissistic side of serial killer personalities, because he is quite narcissistic, and the kind of things that you do and the kind of torment that you apply to other people, there is a narcissistic value. It's a power surge, you know? And I think out of all the family, he was the one who had that. So whether he was torturing rats as a kid, we'll never know. But it's got to come from somewhere. And it's got to be about a lack of respect for the law as well, because they did not respect the law.
Yeah, it sounds like they live in a lawless, as like I said before, like a lawless sort of household, and the parents didn't obviously hold them accountable for anything. And like you said before, Boris is carrying the flag of, you know, anti-Ivan. Well, yeah, Boris is also the one that was going to kill him, right?
Yeah. <So. laughs> And all because of the affair. So, God, you know.
So, yeah, it is. I mean, the likelihood is very clear that as you say, Bill, wouldn't have just have had the incident in 1971 and picked up 20 years later.
Yeah.
The likelihood of that's slim.
Slim and none.
Hey, it was like, no, but
so when was the first? So when was the first murder victim? Like actually attributed
chronologically or discovery?
Well, I guess we'll start with discovery.
So that was 1992. They
in Belangla State Forest.
In Belangla State Forest, which is nearby my house, and I've actually taken a drive through to it on our Facebook page. There's a little video of the drive through it. It's a very scary place. It's so spooky. It's windy roads, and we actually got lost. We had Google Maps, Apple Maps, our car navigation, and we got lost. We couldn't find our way out. It was really a very scary situation. It was a January day. It was rainy and grim and dark. And people think of Australia as this sunny, dry place.
Kangaroos.
Belanglo and the area in the Southern Highlands, it's a cooler climate. And it is although it does get quite hot, you do get your very hot, sunny, hot summer days, but it can get quite misty and gloomy and rainy.
I think it's fair to note too, Sonia, that just the name Belanglo in Australia sort of inspires a feeling of dread. There's just, it attaches to it, you know?
Even you saying it now makes me want to vomit. And Noel's been wanting me to drive him around there. And
you know, morbid fascination and curiosity, as we all have.
I get it. Anybody listening, they get it.
You know, first time I went to New York, I had to go to Amityville. Just is what it is. So, and I'm still expecting her to take me to Belanglo one of these days.
We'll keep you posted. But so that school kids actually still go on camp there and everything. I don't know if I'd be happy sending my kids to go camp in Belanglo.
They used to do ghost tours, but then they stopped doing that because it was disrespectful to the victims. So, but they're still they're trying to build a better reputation about it. But I think it's a losing battle personally. Mm-hmm.
But to carry on with the story, in 1992, they found the first bodies. It was in September of 1992, the first two victims that were found were Joanne Walters and Caroline Clark. They were girls from the UK that were backpacking, and they had gone missing, and their families were looking for them. And it's also just important to note, I mean, everyone knows in the 90s, no one had cell phones and that sort of thing. But just to take a minute and think how scary that is to be a parent at the other side of the world and your child's not in communication with you. Where do you even start looking for them? And that's what these parents were faced with. They made the journey to Australia. They literally drove up and down any highway between the cities, and just based on what the girls said, they thought that they were going to get a job on a strawberry farm. And you look at all the different routes, and the family were driving, and just desperately families were driving, and they were desperately looking for them, and there was just no answer. And then Joanne Walters, they were found the same crime scene. It was in this forest with a fire pit, and it looked like someone had camped there overnight. And it was just
It was like runner. It was like somebody who was running, who went on a run or something like that, who came across it.
It was a runner, yeah. It was two runners. They said they were orienteering. That's right. And in researching this case, I learned what orienteering was.
I wasn't going to ask. So I
was just going to ask.
Orienteering?
apparently that's when you get lost in the woods and find your way out.
On purpose?
In simple terms. It's
a calorie burner, that one.
Apparently it's sort of like a military exercise where you practice to orientate yourself in an unknown location. So people did that as a hobby.
You know what?
Perhaps we get lost in Belanglo. I don't think they would do that anymore. But and then find your way out looking at, I don't know, this position of the sun and getting your direction that way and get yourself out.
But that's what brought them to the discovery. And I guess we can say, well, you know, thank God for them doing what they were doing, because who knows how much longer it would have taken had they not been, you know, in that practice.
Absolutely. And the bodies were identified with dental records. And so at that point, they thought it wasn't a singular incident.
And how long had they been missing at that point, but when the bodies were actually discovered?
I think it was something like, it was a couple of months. So yeah, they were an interesting case because they weren't missing for that long, and then they were found.
But they happened just to be the first bodies.
Right. Yeah. Not necessarily the first victims.
No, they weren't the first victims.
Because she was reported missing in 1992, the same year. So.
Yes. I think they went missing the January of that year, and they were found the September.
Yeah, that would be a horrible feeling to be a parent and to have that.
Well, and just in another country the whole time, you know, it's so far away, not even in your own backyard.
Yeah, they went missing in April, and they were discovered in September.
And reported missing in June.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you think about it, if they went missing in April and reported in June, how many months of that is like not hearing from them? Like the parents probably think, oh, well, we just, you know, we're assuming the better. Maybe they're just, you know, having fun or what have you. But after, you know, 3 months or whatever, like 2 months. Yeah,
And what was another element is the families didn't know each other because they didn't travel together from England. They were both from England, but they met in a backpackers in King's Cross in Australia.
And that's sort of where he would prey on a lot of these backpackers and then, you know, give them a ride on the road to Melbourne. So it was sort of his ETA.
He would meet them outside a train station or whatever and say, well, he was heading down the highway towards Melbourne. Could he give them a ride somewhere? And he was, by all accounts, apparently quite charming. And
yeah, that's all reports that say he was charismatic.
He was charismatic. People didn't feel uneasy with him. And he would have a conversation with them in the car to figure out if they were really alone, if they had family around, if they had any, he would sort of do a bit of a risk assessment, I suppose, because the one guy that, one that got out alive, Paul Onions. He said, he asked him if he had any military training. Paul was also English, and Paul said he had spent some time in the military, but then he wanted to know exactly sort of what his capabilities were in terms of combat.
You know, so, all in friendly conversation.
Yeah, red flags, red flags. Hey, how well are you able to defend yourself?
Yeah, let's say against Australia's worst serial killer, for instance.
Well, you know what? And then he says with Paul Onions, so he stopped the car after all this, you know, interrogation and said that he was looking for cassettes, right? He was just going to get some cassettes so they could listen to music. And then Onions noticed that he had cassettes right there in the dash. So that was sort of he just had the underlying feeling, okay, something's up. And as soon as Millette got out of the car, Onion just took off and ran into the forest and hid.
No, he ran onto the highway, actually.
Onto the highway, okay.
Yeah, he ran in front of a car, and thankfully a person didn't run him over, but stopped and took him to, I think it was Bowral.
But did Millette aim, like he had his gun out too at this point, right? He was trying to shoot it, Paul?
He was shooting, firing at him on the highway
in front of people.
Yes, so they reported this to police. That report went missing, as reports do. Apparently, you have a madman with a gun who almost kidnapped and murdered someone. But yeah, let's not put this on the priority report for the day. Maybe let's see if someone's chicken got stolen.
You know what, if I could just say, doing these episodes, doing the research and reading, and you find out just how sometimes law enforcement is either just bumbling and just, you know, like stupid, or they just don't care. It's interesting how many times that comes into play when you read about these cases.
Yeah, and I think I was going to say that they also get narrow-minded too. There's like, they can get focused on one particular, you know, idea, and then everything else just falls to the wayside, and then 20 years go by and you're like, oh shit, we didn't think about that when we should have been.
It's like, how obvious was it now? How come that wasn't obvious then? And I don't think it's because we have better technology now. It's almost just like you didn't connect A to B.
Well, sometimes it is the power of hindsight, but I also think sadly a young healthy man who escaped from a bad situation is a non-event.
Yeah.
Especially in the 90s. You should have defended yourself, or you could have. I've got a bit of an issue with how men are helped in bad situations, because everyone should deserve the same kind of attention or help, whether it's a male or a female. I mean, you had no chance against Millet and his gun.
And I think
if you're Dwayne Johnson, you wouldn't have had a chance against him because he was so ruthless.
Oh, and the games that he would play. I think there's just something to say about the way men are looked at in this country in particular.
Yeah.
If you can't hold your own, then that's not anybody's fault but your own. You know, that sort of outlook.
Just careful there. No, we don't want to get.
No, I'm not saying that. But that could be not a blanket statement, but it could be said about just toxic masculinity, if you will, you know, and that is a real thing.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, be a man's man, defend yourself, what's your problem? And that sort of thing.
You can edit that out, right, Bill?
No, that part, well, you know, to be honest with you, that is absolutely, that is an issue. And that it's not just an issue in your country. It's an issue in all countries. At least in the States, I can guarantee you it's an issue here, because if you ask for help for something, or if you need, you know, let's say mental health assistance, there's a stigma that goes along with it. And it's just like, nobody seems to understand that the hardest thing to do is to ask for help, and then to have somebody judge you for asking for help or for not being able to deal with it yourself or be a man or, you know, pull up your bootstraps. It's just, there is such a toxicity that goes along with that.
Yeah. And it's unnecessary, and it's, yeah, let's not, I get very angry about.
But it is definitely makes sense what you're saying. And I do agree with that. And you know, in Paul Onion's defense, thank God, because he was the one who was able to start shedding a little bit more light onto things by talking to the police.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs, so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
He was the only witness, because he was the one that got away, that could explain what went on inside the car. So what he would then typically do, after Paul Onions came out, more witnesses came out, females that said that they were hitchhiking, they were picked up by this guy. He went onto a rural road and said, oh, it's a shortcut. And the minute he did that, they felt uneasy. And he
would always
over.
Stop the car, right? And like, yeah. He'd always stop the car, get out, with some sort of reason why he was getting out, just so he can bring his gun.
So he can bring his gun. And then, I mean, because then they stopped. There was a story of an attempted rape, and the two girls actually managed to get away from him, and they ran away too. So Paul wasn't the only one who got away. And they went to the nearest farmhouse they could find, and they also, but they didn't report it. They were shaken up, and they just went on their way. They were heading to Canberra, I believe. But after Paul Onions came out, they said, well, hang on, it's the same story as we had. Just from the locations the various bodies were found in Belanglo, what they could figure out is Mulat would pick his victims up. Promise says he has a sort of shortcut. He's local to the area. Go into Belanglo Forest, which is a maze. It's so, even if he dropped you there, you wouldn't have found your way home. If they were a couple, he would disable the strongest one.
Which came from the interrogations. He would find that out. And
they actually found that through the composition of some of the crime scenes with forensics. So like in Gabor Neugebauer and Anja Hapschit, they were boyfriend and girlfriend from Germany. And Gabor, the male, he actually severed his spine. So he was paralyzed.
Yeah, but alive.
But alive. So he did this with more than one of his the victim situations. He'd take the stronger one, disable them, but kept them alive so they could watch the murder of the other one. The other one would be then raped and placed up against a tree, and he would do target practice by shooting and seeing how many targets would hit. And they were able to, it was rough for them to figure that out, because it doesn't sound like someone would do that. But they picked up from all the shell casings they picked up, they figured this guy was actually target shooting on a person.
Yeah, having fun. That was having the thing fun. That they were saying. It was more of, yeah, it's like a leisurely day out, if you will, you know? Yeah.
And this after he killed them.
No, this is when he hit incapacitated the stronger person.
Oh,
okay. Because yeah, if you read about some of the descriptions, like, you know, one of the victims had like 14 stab wounds, and that was just for incapacitating. The second person, if it wasn't a pair, then would be killed but almost taunted before that person got killed. And the other person, the partner, would watch before he ultimately or she ultimately met her fate. So it definitely imbibed him with power. You know, that was definitely the case with that. So
yeah, he stabbed them in the back to
literally.
Yeah, he stabbed them. And then he also shot. And I think that's for a long time why they felt that there were two perpetrators, because it was two different methods. And they just felt maybe one of the brothers did the stabbing and the one did the shooting. But that could never be proven. And one police officer said, yeah, well, that is Ivan Milat. He didn't care how he did it. Knife, gun. He saw people as animals that he was hunting and slaughtering, and he didn't care which method, whichever one worked best at that given moment.
I mean, this is a horror movie. This is absolutely, this is horrifying. I mean, to think what these victims went through before they actually died, the ones that were incapacitated.
That is the cruelest thing of it all. And the fact that he just, he took his time. He knew the forest so well, and he knew no one would stumble across them in the middle of the night. No one goes into that forest.
And looking on those roads, he knows where in the forest he can take them. You know, he probably has it all mapped out.
And even it's quite dense. So if he found his spot and it's deep in there, and if there was someone, let's say, on an off-road motorbike or something, he'd hear them come for miles. So he'd know how to bunker down and hide or something. But he kept those victims there for hours at end.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how long he kept the victims alive for, if he kept them alive for more than a day or if he killed them.
From the research that I could find, a lot of them were found many months after. So it was only skeletal remains. So they couldn't say exactly how long they were tortured for. But I think it was more a matter of hours than days necessarily. Yeah.
He would have to get back home. He you know, he would go back home after this, and it would just be sort of, Ivan's back and we're back to our normal familial habits.
Yeah.
Did Ivan have a family at this point?
No, he never did marry, but his sister Shirley lived with him. And that's what the... So it was said that they had the incestuous affair.
But he was with Shalinder too, right? That was his actual girlfriend, which is just nothing crazy, but he was quite xenophobic, and he would, you know, say things about different races of people, according to some of the victims. I think Paul Onions is the one who really hit that one home. But, you know, and then he then he was very committed once he got together with Shalinder, who was an Indian-born Australian, yeah?
Yeah. So, and he was a neat freak.
That's right.
He used to wash his car. It was always spotless. It looked brand new.
Okay. I found this on the web for his to wash his car.
Okay. So we got a new person.
Welcome to the show, Siri.
Siri. And this show is sponsored by Apple. Yeah, so yeah, he was a neat freak, and he had a shed on his property, and that is where the police eventually found some of the evidence.
It was like rings
hidden in the attic almost of the shed. There was a ceiling, and it was in the ceiling. And they also found, I think it was Simone Schmidl's backpack the guest room. Shirley came forward and said, no, it's her backpack. Wasn't
complicit.
Shirley had never been to Germany, and this backpack was purchased in Germany. It just, yeah, she pulled a Milat. Yeah, it was me. It's mine. I got it.
So, okay. So now we have Paul Onions has gotten away. We have two murder victims that have been found. So who happens to be the next lucky person to cross his path, or unlucky person, I should say.
He didn't murder anybody during the investigation.
Yeah, then he stopped.
It was sort of like when the bodies were being found, there was no more. So I guess the most recent bodies that were found was it Deborah Everest and James Gibson?
They were third and fourth, so they were I think the only Australian ones. They were traveling from, they were from Melbourne. They had been up to Sydney for New Year's Eve and they were hitchhiking their way back down to Melbourne. And the plan was to stop off at a music festival and they never made it home. So yeah, they were just 19 years old. It's just kids.
It's basically, yeah, when you come of certain age, I mean, and then, you know, I don't think we do this that much in the States, Bill.
No.
But it seems here, you like when you get out of school, you go and travel. That's a wonderful thing to think about. Like, it's an exciting thing to think about. Okay, I'm at school. It's before I'm going to start my career. But I'm going to take a year and just go experience the world. They come to Australia because there's this whole just Australia being, you know, so far away, land down under and all these cool things. And we're going to backpack it because you can. Never thinking that somebody has ulterior motives. And I think that's what all these people had in common was they were doing just that. They were just trying to experience the world and have some fun and just fell into the wrong hands.
Yeah.
I think that everybody wants to believe that there's nothing to worry about. And it doesn't happen until you look back on the situation sometimes and realize that something else was going on while you weren't even aware. Like you said, there weren't any murders going on during the investigation, but you know, nobody knew there were a bunch of murders going on during the murder spree.
Yeah.
So what was the time frame from his, considering like from when he first committed the murder, the first murder to when he was caught?
So the first one was actually the one we were talking about. That was about 1989. And then, but they were only found towards the end. I think that's a bit more of a confusion now talking to you is when the murders occurred and when the bodies were found. So to Deborah and James were... They went missing in 1989.
So out of the seven, that was the first people chronologically to go missing.
And then...
1989 was a bad year. So many bad things happened that year.
And Dodgers won the World Series. I'm just kidding. but I think it was some. Was it Simone who was next?
Yes, she was. Simone was also a German girl who traveled, and her mother was coming to join her for a little bit from Germany, and they had arranged to meet at Melbourne Airport, and Simone didn't show up again. In the early 90s, where do you start to look? You don't know where she stayed before, exactly what her route was that she took, who her friends were.
Yeah, because she was solo. She went solo the whole
time. She was solo. Yeah. She was the only one that was solo.
Yeah, it's not like you have Google tracking you like you do today.
No. Or social media that you can spot a photo with something in the background. Oh, she must have been at this cafe or something. It was extremely hard to find them. Then it was Anya and Gabor. So they were found in 1993.
What actually brought the investigators to his front door?
So they had a task force because after the first discovery of Caroline and Joanne's bones in Belanglo, there was a local man who he lives in Bundanoon. Mm-hmm. He went into the forest. He was quite taken by this case, and he just thought, well, if there are bodies of two travelers, and there were reports of missing backpackers in the area. There were many reports of missing backpackers. So the area was sort of, it was a mystery. I spoke to a lot of local people who lived here at the time. So they were aware of the missing persons cases from the late 80s to the early 90s. They were aware, oh, another two backpackers gone missing. So it didn't come out of the blue. It was just missing persons, and it was a mystery. No one paid too much attention to it.
The law enforcement was just, we got other things to worry about.
Yeah, so they did what they could, but as I say, with no leads, with nothing, how do you even find them? So they were never found. Then these two skeletal remains were found, and all the skeletal remains of two people were found, and the local man just went rummaging in the woods looking for more. And I think, Bruce Pryor. He found Deborah and James. So the first couple. So he found more remains, and then police looked at him.
See, and the thing to note too, just as an aside, is that James, like Gabor, also had his spine severed. So that just goes back to Malat's how he would incapacitate the stronger victims. He would literally sever their spine.
And did he have military training, or like how did he know how to do that? Or was that just something that you probably picked up living on a lawless farm?
Yeah, he wasn't military. He wasn't military or anything like that.
No, he wasn't military. He was just a serial killer.
He's probably experimenting. Can I do this? Oh,
there we go. Training on the job.
Learning on the job.
So because there aren't that many gun clubs in Australia as there probably you would find in the States. So the police went to the local shooting range because of all the shell casings they found and the bullet holes in the victims' skulls. And they tried to find, they went on a trail to look for the weapon. And that's how they came across, it wasn't one of the Milat brothers. And then the rabbit trail just took them into the whole Milat clan and trying to figure out for a long time, well, who did it? For a while, they did actually think it was Paul Miller. And
that was Richard.
Richard.
So let's go back to this Paul Miller character. So why does he have an alias?
I think he said it was to avoid traffic tickets or what?
He was trying to dodge some sort. I thought it was not alimony, but he was trying.
It was.
It was alimony?
Yeah.
What the hell?
You know, and just
what
on
guy?
That.
Sort of,
it's anytime there was something going on, anything that was, you know, not just murder, but just Malat name would always come up to police officers when certain things would go down. A robbery. It was just almost like, well, the Malats are known, they're on the radar, but they still didn't put two and two together with any of the murders, you know, the backpackers. They didn't put that. And then what sort of brought that was when they finally figured out that a Malat was actually working on the roads during the times that these bodies must have died, when they started actually doing a timeline. And that's how they linked it to Ivan, because he was the only one who was working for the road system.
And interestingly enough, everyone who knew the family said that Ivan was the least likely one.
Probably because he's the most handsomest. No,
yeah.
Literally, like.
Well, I mean, like you said before, I mean, we talked about it earlier. I mean, you do have to have a bit of charisma to be able to con somebody into your vehicle. I don't care.
The Bundy syndrome.
It's so straight Bundy. This is definitely Bundy-esque. But you definitely have to have that sort of aura about yourself and confidence that you're going to be able to, one, pull it off, and two, not give away your ulterior motive, like you mentioned before.
Yeah, and I suppose because he got away with it so many times, that built his confidence too.
Yeah, because he could have probably been getting away with it for years before he actually came on the radar.
So that it was really, they were really actually investigating the family. They had the feeling it was one of the brothers.
And that seed was planted because of the Paul Miller, and because they were all in that same area. Like going back to Borrell, the engineering company in the Southern Highlands, two of the brothers worked there. One of them was Richard, who went under the name Paul Miller. He had two IDs, one Richard Malat, one Paul Miller. And they just kept going back to the Malats, yeah, Sonia? And that's when they found out that, oh, shoot, Ivan was working on the roads. Let's question him.
And they also, they searched the Milat properties because they had a couple of properties around the area.
Yeah, the brother and like the brothers.
Some brothers would buy something together. And so they found some evidence but could never definitively link it. But then, the backpacks found at Ivan's house in a morning raid, that's what got him in the end.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time this week, but I would like to invite you guys back for part two and the conclusion to The Backpack Killer next Friday on Who Killed. And thank you so much to Noel and Sonia from the Evidence Locker podcast for joining me this week. It is really cool that they were able to join me from down under. And with the technology that we have, it's pretty amazing that we are able to do such things. So, as a reminder, I drop new episodes of Who Killed every Friday. I'm going to be mixing in some of my Passion Case episodes on the Who Killed feed. And I guess I would say, for the second year in a row, I will be representing Who Killed and Who Killed Amy Mahalovic, as well as my Passion Case on podcast Row at CrimeCon 2020 in Orlando. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with the situation there, so if you want to buy a ticket and you would like to save, you can use my promo code AMY2020. The new dates are October 30th through November 1st. So if you enjoy these podcasts that I produce, you can help support independent journalism by clicking on the donate button on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com. That is slow minus the W. You can also contribute to the show via the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3 or via PayPal with my email address. I will also provide a link in the show notes. And every contribution does help keep these Slow Burn podcasts running. You can also help support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you get your favorite shows. Those 5 stars do help keep the important cases that I cover in the spotlight. So anybody who's got any information about any of the cases that I've covered that are unsolved, please contact either Crime Stoppers or the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. If you'd like to stay up to date on the cases I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have in the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you guys again so much for listening, and until next time, please be healthy and stay safe.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.